So you did stage Susan B. Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like to create that in Hudson Hall?
Yeah, it was great because my idea for how we could produce it was to just find a bunch of people who lived up here to put it on, which is kind of daunting for that piece because it has, I think, like 32 named characters. It's a really big ensemble piece. It's written by Gertrude Stein and Virgil Thompson. Virgil Thompson, there was a big age gap. He was like this young guy who was kind of obsessed with her. He was an ambitious composer. And she, at that point, was sort of grand dame of American avant-garde. And they had been talking about projects. I think they had already written an opera or two together. And she wanted to write an opera about Susan B. Anthony because she thought that Susan B. Anthony was a great American figure. And I think she also was interested in how Susan B. Anthony had this very long life. Like, she was like 80-something years old when she died. And she lived during this huge period of American life. And so this opera, The Mother of Us All, is this kind of fantasy of real... I mean, the whole thing is a fiction. But she's taking real American figures, Andrew Johnson, Susan B. Anthony, Daniel Webster, and some fictional characters from her other writing, and then just made up characters. And she's kind of imagining them all in a community, showing up at town halls, arguing about politics. Also, she shows scenes, domestic scenes, between Susan B. Anthony and her partner, Anne, debating the kind of things that one debates in the house about gender, about politics, about power. And it's just this fascinating piece about history, gender, and also grammar, meaning structure, meaning form. And so it was really interesting to us to, on a larger level, like, investigate, like, how do we produce an opera in this space, which is not a production company, which is not an opera company. So we started doing these, like, casting calls, just looking for people who like to sing, and asking people to come sing for us. And I put together a production team, this amazing dramaturg who came from the Bard College world, who Tammy Dillon put us together with. Her name is Joan Metallic. A designer named Marsha Ginsburg, who has a family home up in the Berkshires. This crazy lighting designer, friend of mine named Jax Messenger, who was doing all these scrappy DIY downtown shows with me in New York. And a music director named Tony Corraldo, who's a guy who lived in town. So we were like the production team. And so people would come and sing for us, and amazingly, we discovered up in this region, there are some of the top opera singers working in the world. There's other opera singers who live up here and travel the world. We found people who had like understudied productions of The Mother of Us All at New York City Opera, but never sang the roles themselves, but they still had the piano vocal score in their library. We also discovered people who just like to sing, you know, in bands around town or in the shower or in like church choirs or whatever. And so we just started casting this incredible slice of life and this mix of people who... all had different kind of vocal styles and different backgrounds. And in a way, it was perfect for the piece. Because that piece, you just need a really great dramatic singer for Susan B. Anthony. And then everybody else, it could be a little quirkier, a little more eccentric. So, amazingly, at the time, I was with this... my artist management company was called CAMI, Columbia Artist Management, Inc., which is a really famous artist management company in New York, which folded during the pandemic. But this was, you know, before they folded. And one of the singers on the roster was this mezzo-soprano named Michaela Martins. And when I was telling people up here about this idea for this project, somebody at one point said, oh, you know, Michaela Martins lives up here. You should talk to her. And I knew the name because I'd seen her on the roster of my management company. And then I met with somebody else, and I was telling them about the project, and they said, oh, you know, Mickey Martins lives up here. You should really talk to her. And I thought, oh, that's funny. And then a third person I was talking with, and they said, oh, you know, Michaela Martins. I said, okay, fine, fine. Yes, you're the third person who's told me. It's a sign from the universe. I got it. I'll call her. So I wrote to my manager, and I said, look, we're doing this. Mother's Law. I heard Michaela Martins lives 20 minutes from Hudson. Could you write to her manager and tell her to take me seriously? Because I'm going to ask her if she wants to do this project. So he reached out to his manager, who then reached out to me and said, can you give me a call? And so I called him up, and he said, RB, I just talked to Michaela, and she said, who is this kid who thinks he can sell five performances of The Mother of Us All in Hudson? And so I told her, Michaela, that's how we talked. I told her, Michaela, why don't you go have lunch with him? Let him take you out to lunch and let him tell you his idea. So he put us in touch, and I invited her to come to Warren Street. There, at that time, there was a restaurant called Kamea, which was right across the alley from the Opera House. And I was so nervous to meet her because I was very young in my career at that point. And she was, you know, I knew that she was kind of a big star. And I also felt like it felt kind of weird and synchronistic that I had discovered her and found her and been connected with her. And it made me just wonder, like, what is the power of this place? That could be maybe a theme of our talk. I think there's some kind of power, magic in that building. For me, at least. So anyway, I took her out to lunch, and then we had a great chat, and we were just talking about just life and this business and the opera career and the kind of work that I've been doing in New York and my vision for how to do this project in Hudson and why I wanted to do this piece. And then I took her over to see the building after lunch and introduce her to the staff, and it must have been after the renovation, or maybe it was still like mid-construction at that point. I can't really remember. But anyway, I just remember she was standing in the middle of the room, and she looked around the room, and then she looked back at me, and she said, do you think I can do it? And I said, of course I think you can do it. And she said, okay, I'll do it. And I walked her to her car. And then the next time I saw her was our first day of rehearsal. And in between that period of time, I was never really sure that she was ever going to show up. But she showed up that first day, and she was unbelievable. And she was such a force. And she believed so. I'd never worked with someone who just arrived with such absolute trust and open collaboration and authenticity and just fire. And she was unbelievable in that role. And it was really, like, I think for her it was like a very defining moment in her career as an artist. And her it's more than commitment, but just her engagement with the material and the way she showed up as an artist set such a tone for everybody else. Like I said, there were people in the cast who, you know, sing in bands around town and are watching this opera singer who is working at the top of their career, giving their full force. And I think it just made everybody just totally commit and bring such authenticity to the project. And it was a huge hit, and we ended up being the New York Times, one of the New York Times' 10 best productions of 2017, which was kind of amazing because we're not even in New York City. So it was kind of a huge deal for our community, for the hall. And it made me really think, like, damn, there's something happening here. Something is possible here that I don't think could happen anywhere else. Like, I don't think that project could have happened in any other building. And I think there's something magic. There's like some kind of gravitational force, I think, in that building.
How were you feeling on opening night?
I think I was just really nervous about if it was going to work or not. Like, it's funny because this was like 10 years ago, and I've done so much more work since then, and I don't have that same kind of nervousness that I had back then, which is great. I'm really happy realizing that now. I'm more confident in my abilities to put something together.
So that was 2016?
The premiere was in 2017, but I think we started developing it in 2016, maybe the end of 2015, in terms of like the first conversations and then like figuring out that there was this grant and then applying for the grant and then getting the grant and then being like, oh shit, now we actually have to do it. We have to figure out how we're going to actually do it. These opera projects take a long time.
I imagine that Hudson communities have also changed from then to now.
Yeah.
If you kind of transport yourself back to that moment, what did your Hudson community look like?
When I remember that period of time, I was at a gala the other night with someone who's lived in Hudson for, you know, decades. And she and I were talking about, you know, that kind of boring thing that we all do now, like, oh, it's changed so much, and oh, I hardly recognize Warren Street anymore, and blah, blah, blah. And, but you know, in the last 10 years, 5 years, we've lost a lot of people. A lot of the people who I thought of as, like, core Hudson people have died. Shops have closed. And I was saying to her, like, when I came to Hudson for the first time, I just thought, you walk up and down Warren Street and you just encountered these galleries and these shops and these artists who you just felt like everybody was in Hudson and they were popping up and doing their thing. And they were like... they kind of like did things their own way. They marched the beat of their own drum. And it was kind of extraordinary to walk in place after place and just walk into these worlds that were so fully authentic and articulated, one after another, up and down the street, whether it was a restaurant or it was a gallery or a shop, antique shop. And I felt like this is a place where people go who don't play by the rules or who do things their own way. And everybody showed up for each other's stuff. Like, if you went to a gallery opening, everybody was there. And if you went to a performance, everybody showed up. Or if there was like a party down at the Half Moon, everyone was there. And that kind of blew my mind because it was, it felt like a community. And anyway, I was kind of whinging about that with somebody the other day, and the way she articulated it was that the first time she came to Hudson back in like the 90s or the early 2000s, she felt like shop after shop, she just was encountering the most talented people she'd ever met in her entire life. She just couldn't believe that all these people were here in Hudson together. And I said to her, well, Peggy, that's how I felt about you when I met you. So... you know, you are the thing that you saw in these other people. So it was a sweet moment.
Tell me about one of the people who's died.
There was this amazing guy named Vince Mulford, who had this shop on Warren Street that it was this gigantic shop, and he was a kind of petite man, and he specialized in gigantic objects. So you would go in and there would just be like one giant table in the middle. And he joked that he got the space because he was collecting all this giant stuff and he had nowhere to show it. And then he got the space for cheap, and it was a place where he could display his giant artifacts that he found. And he had this on the second floor of his building. I guess when he moved into the space, I remember him telling me it was like drop ceilings and broken up into all these cubicles, and it was some kind of data telephone something. And when he ripped all that out, he found that there was all this amazing architectural detail, including on the second floor, a tin-ceilinged ballroom. And so he put a bar in one corner, and at least once a year, he would have some fabulous party there, and usually in the summer, and everybody would show up, and you would dance and drink. And it had this incredible view looking out over the city. And he was just totally magic. And I met him. He was special to me because my dad, who was a lawyer in Cooperstown, had done some kind of work for Vince. My dad was a tax lawyer, and so he did some kind of accounting tax help for Vince. And Vince always really appreciated it. So when I introduced myself, he kind of connected that. And so in those early days of being in Hudson, it was kind of nice that there was somebody here who had a connection to my family. So that was sweet. But he passed right before COVID, or maybe right in the beginning of COVID, not from COVID, but from cancer. It was just so sad. It was kind of the beginning of a lot of people from his era, because he was probably in his 70s. And yeah, we've lost a lot of people to various illnesses over the past 5-6 years who are kind of that generation. The people who came to Hudson in like the 90s, when the joke was you only came to Hudson to buy drugs or get beat up. But there were these kind of brave, undaunted people who came and started popping up in these empty storefronts with their worlds, with their galleries, with their art. Or that's at least the story as I've heard it.
How did you get an appreciation for people who march to their own drumbeat?
That's a good question. It's probably because I was kind of raised by people like that. My mom and my dad had a very kind of traditional relationship in that, like, he had a business in town, he was a lawyer. My mom was she jokes that when she was a girl, you could only become a nurse or a secretary or a teacher. So she became a teacher. And then when she had me, she became a stay-at-home mom and was really devoted to me. And then maybe when I was in my teens, she went back to work as a guidance counselor. And my parents were just, they are extremely solid people, and weren't from Cooperstown. My dad was from Ohio, and my mom was from Long Island, and so they kind of came to this town and made a life there because they had an attraction to the place. And yeah, so I guess I always felt like that was possible. I learned that from them. And Hudson, you know, it's like not so far from where I grew up, but like it wasn't a part of my early life. It was very much a thing that I found kind of as I was going out into my adulthood, in my, you know, post-college. When I met my husband, he was living in New York, and he had been spending summers in Hudson as a dancer, doing these kind of dance residencies in these empty found spaces around town. And so it was funny meeting him in New York, and he knew about Hudson, and I was going to spend the summer in Hudson. I met him right before I came up for that job at Bard. And so that felt kind of like fate that we met, and we both kind of knew about this place. And then my best friend moved to town. She and I went to college together in Ithaca. She's like definitely a character who marches to the beat of her own drum. I think most of my friendships are people like that. Yeah, there's something about that that I respond to. I think Cooperstown, because I was obsessed with this opera festival, which also, in a way, is like a symbol of what's the word? Not unconventional, but like the way my parents tell me the story is when they moved to town, in, to Cooperstown in like the late 70s, there was this group of people who loved opera and they started this opera company in high school. And that in the 70s in the US, there were a lot of opera singers, opera enthusiasts who were just like popping up in their like small town auditoriums, high school auditoriums, and like doing operas. And it was kind of a revelation for people because they were like, oh, you don't need to go to Manhattan, you don't need to go to the Met to see opera, it can happen in this small town. So that was the story of how Glimmerglass started. And it was so successful and so popular that eventually they built their own theater. And it's this kind of incredible theater that was built on a turkey farm. Someone donated the land that had been a turkey farm right on the lake, Lake Otsego. And they hired this New York City architect, Hugh Hardy, who designed this opera house, which is in like a barn vernacular. So the outside of it kind of looks like a kind of barn that you would see all over the landscape of that part of New York State. And yet you would show up at this barn opera house in the summers and you would go inside and you would encounter like world-class performance. People who came from Europe, people who came from the city, people came from all over to perform on the stage. And these summer festivals were so magical. And so I think there's something about growing up around that, knowing that that's possible, has always been really interesting to me. And like the possibility for kind of popping up and creating a container to make a magical shared experience is like something that I find very instinctive. Like, for example, what I'm doing here in Hudson Hall.
Is there a teacher or a mentor you could tell me about? Could be an opera or any part of your life.
Well, someone who was very formative for me was this guy named Matthew Epstein, who was an artist manager. And he, among many things, he was one of the people who worked at CAMI, the artist management place I was talking about. And he was a very prominent figure there. Like one of the people whose careers he had a big influence on was Renee Fleming, who's today one of the most famous opera singers in the business. And he, I met because he had worked with and was best friends with the director that I had been assisting when I was trying to break into the industry. So this was back in like 2009. And I bring him up because he is the first person who introduced me to an opera by Handel, which is called Dei de Mia. And it also kind of links up to the year 2012. So in 2011 was when I went to, when I worked at the Bard Summerscape and came to Hudson, fatefully, on a day off. Also, that was the summer I met my husband. Also, that was the year that my friend Zia from college moved to Hudson. And so we were living in New York, but I was really, we were coming up and staying with Zia all the time. She actually was like living across the street, working as a nanny. And we, so then the next summer, 2012, I was out working for the summer at a festival in Colorado. And when I finished, when I was out there, Matthew, who spent summers at Santa Fe as an artistic advisor there, he said, you should really come when you're done with your season in Colorado. You should come to Santa Fe. because you should see the festival, you should meet people, they should meet you. So I flew down to Santa Fe, and the Santa Fe Opera is one of the top summer festivals. They joke that they're the Glimmerglass of the West. And they have this incredible outdoor theater in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert. It was built by a bunch of opera enthusiasts who went out there from New York City and created this space. And anyway, it's grown into this giant economic driver. It's known for its artistic excellence. So I go out there in 2012, and he said, "You can stay with me, and take me out to dinner a couple times as a thank you, and I'll make sure you get tickets to everything and you meet everybody." And so I went out there, and I remember him saying, "Let's go for a drive. I'll show you the town." And so we got in his car, and he put in a CD, because this was back when you actually listened to CDs in cars. And it was an archival recording of De Demia, this Handel opera. And he was like, "You got to hear this music. It's so fabulous. It's from a production that just happened in the Netherlands. No one ever does this opera. It hasn't been done in the U.S. for like over 40 years. It's a masterpiece." And so I remember driving around Santa Fe and listening to this music and thinking, "My God, this music is amazing. This place is so enchanting. Maybe I should do this opera someday." Because Handel is kind of my favorite opera composer. So flash forward to, we do The Mother of Us All. Then COVID hits. Opera stops, especially because it's an art form that, you know, aerosols on people close to you. So none of us can figure out, like, how do you do operas in a safe way right now? We're being told that, like, aerosols are the main way of spreading this pandemic. And so my industry basically shuts down. I just kind of go into, like, grief mode, because I just cannot imagine what's happening in the world, what's happening with my industry, what's happening in my career. And then at some point during that first summer, that summer of 2020, I started listening to this Handel opera called Rodolinda. And I got really into it, really moved by the music, really captivated by it. And I started looking at the story, what's going on, who are these characters, and I thought, oh wow, it's about this woman whose husband has just disappeared, maybe he's dead. Suddenly all these people are descending on her kingdom. There's all these kind of back alley grabs for power. She's in the midst of her, like, grief and rage. She's trying to protect her home and her young son from these people who are descending. Eventually the husband isn't dead, and he comes back, and he gets captured, and they're both being held, and they're going to be killed. And then the sister sets him free, and then he kills the bad guy and confronts one of the other bad guys, and then says, "I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to let you live, knowing that I'm the one who spared your life, and that it will be a greater punishment to you than death would be." And then this marriage reunites, and he returns to his rightful role as the king or whatever. And I was just looking at this piece, and I thought, wow, thematically it's dealing with so much of what's going on right now. But as a story, it just feels like this kind of, like, domestic Victorian melodrama, this moral melodrama. And wouldn't it be kind of amazing to do it on the stage at Hudson Hall as, like, a real costume drama, with, like, footlights and top hats and hoop skirts? So then a few years later, I took it to them. I guess it was like 2022. I went to the hall and I said, "I don't know if you guys are ready to start talking about another project," because, you know, we still weren't really out of the COVID woods yet. We still weren't really doing public performances at that point. And kind of amazingly, they said, "Yes, we'd love to do commission a Handel opera from you, but we'd like it to be the beginning of a series of Handel operas from you." And so at that moment, I immediately thought, great, I want to do Rodolinda. Then I want to do Giulio Cesare, which was the Handel opera that I was supposed to do during COVID, but it had been canceled. So it was a piece I'd been thinking about already. And then I thought, the third one, I'm going to finally do De Demia, which I've been wanting to do ever since Matthew introduced it to me all these years ago. And then kind of amazingly, right after Rhodelinda premiered, and it was a big hit, and we were a New York Times critics pick, and suddenly people were like, wow, Hudson could become a Baroque opera destination. This is so impressive what just happened. The Santa Fe Opera invited me to come to Santa Fe and bring our production of Rhodelinda and reimagine it for their theater, this outdoor theater for 2,000 seats, much different than our Victorian stage for 275 seats. So I'm about in a few weeks to go out to Santa Fe to begin rehearsals for that. So that's been very exciting to kind of reconnect with the Santa Fe thread. And Matthew came and saw Giulio Cesare, which was what we did last spring, and he was just wild about the space and what's possible there, and he has been very involved with helping me cast De Demia, which we're now getting ready to announce next week or the week after. So that's been an exciting thread through this last 15 years of my life, my Hudson life.
It's exciting.
It's amazing how everything connects when you look backwards, I think.
How does it feel to be further along in your career? You know, you talked about the nervousness of when you were earlier in your career.
I love getting further into my career. I think most people probably say that. It just feels great. It feels just at a new level, and I'm just really excited about what's possible.
And what are you hoping for in the future?
Well, I'm just really hoping for more Hudson. I just love this place. I think there's something magic here, and I love what it's been possible to create here. And I'm kind of curious what we'll keep doing, because we have been growing this opera series and it's going very well, and we keep refining how to do it better, and we keep building an audience, which is kind of amazing. You know that story that of Michaela Martin saying to her agent, who is this kid who thinks he could sell 5 performances of Mother of Saul, I was very happy even before we opened that show, we had sold it out. And so I was very happy to call her up one day. This was like very early days of rehearsals. And I said, Michaela, just so you know, we've already sold out 5 performances. And that felt very good. So all that is to say, like, it's incredible that people, that there's this audience up here who will come to stuff. And just last night I was having dinner with some colleagues from Glimmerglass Opera, and they were kind of bemoaning how magical it seems here and what we're making, and how it just seems so kind of easy and people want to be here and it's such a hub. And I said, yeah, well, that's Hudson. It's always been a hub ever since it was the center of trade, and it's always been a place that people pass through and bring their ideas. And it's somehow very accessible for this region. So, I don't know. I think there's some kind of pull here. And I just feel really grateful to be here in the gravitational pull.
Sounds like almost spiritual, like something, what you said, magical possibility.
Yeah, for me, I definitely feel that here. I feel that this is where I'm supposed to be. And so I'm just trying to be here and give back and just lean into the magic, pay attention to the signs.
What does giving back mean?
Well, I think that this opera series is a way of giving back. Opera is my passion. Opera is my specialty. It's the thing that I know about. It's the thing that's instinctive to me. I've always known I wanted to be an opera director ever since I was 10 and I was sitting in on opera rehearsals and I saw that there was somebody called an opera director who told people where to stand and what to do. And I was sitting there in my chair watching and I was thinking, why is that? That chair should be over there and that person should be over there. And just this weird kind of sixth sense for this. I joke that I think that being an opera director is like a past life thing. I think it's like someone said that about gardening, that gardening is too big of a thing to finish in one lifetime. So you're probably going to keep investigating it across multiple lifetimes. And so I kind of joke that opera directing is like that too, because I just think it's a mammoth thing, and I don't come from a theater family. My parents were very musical, but not in a professional way. You know, they liked singing in community choirs, and my mom was a very good pianist and studied voice. So music was always in the home, and music as an expression is very normal in the home. But it's weird to be so attracted to this career. But it's cool now to be like working out in the world. Right now I'm starting to get hired by some of the top opera companies in the world, which is very exciting to go and experience how opera happens at these high levels. I also do a lot of work with students in conservatory settings, and it's really cool to be around this young generation of people who are really so passionate about this art form and are extremely talented. And so it's kind of fun to come back here then and try to make something happen for this building, which I love, and try to bring the expertise, bring in people that I've met out in the field, also find the people who live up here like me, who've chosen this region, and they're like this series, the way it kind of works is to create a nice balance between people who live up here and people who come in as guests. Both guests who are like people who work at the top level of their field, but also who are emerging young artists who are looking for performance opportunities and who, you know, maybe haven't been discovered by everybody yet. A lot of young singers I talk to who are just out of conservatory settings are looking for the opportunity to get to do a full role, because that's something that is really necessary for your training as an artist, and this is a good place to do that. So it just feels like a place that can really be of use to people, and maybe that's the purpose of the city hall. Because that's the other thing that really interests me about the building is, it's, as I've said, it's not an opera house, even though it's called the Hudson Opera House. And I think something that's so interesting about it is I feel like when it's used as a city hall, whatever that means, maybe what that means is to be of use to people, it seems to vibrate in a certain way. I like that. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. I'll pause.
What's useful?
I imagine that you speak with the press from time to time, that you do interviews. Is there any question that journalists don't ask you that you wish they would ask you?
Ugh, that's interesting. I can't think of that. The thing that everybody usually asks when I do interviews, because usually I'm doing interviews about a certain piece, people always ask me what the piece is about, and I always hate that, because I think that opera especially is like not, it's not a narrative art form, I don't think. Like, I don't think you should go because of the story. Yes, the story is like an energizing through line. But I think as like an art form, like cinema or like television, serial television is more of like a narrative art form. Opera is this like overwhelming experience of sound and physicality and kind of human spectacle, like people who can make this noise and people who can, it's really like people who can make this noise. Maybe noise is reductive, but I just find singing when it's from people who have been studying this craft for so long and who can produce this amazingly beautiful and powerful sound from within their bodies, and you're sitting in a room with them and you're being kind of vibrated by that, like that's such a overwhelmingly powerful experience, I think. And that's one of the things that has made the work at Hudson Hall so exciting, because it's such an intimate venue. You're so close to the performers, and I think you get to have kind of that experience that I had when I was a kid, 10 years old, sitting in a rehearsal room, you know, the size of the room we're sitting in right now, up close to this artistry. And I think that's so captivating. And so I always tell people, like, don't worry about the stories, just go and, you know, go for the interpersonal, emotional dynamics, and go for the experience. And so, yeah. Maybe I should start all interviews from now on just saying, don't ask me about the story because I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, and you talked about the importance of people showing up, you know, how, especially back in the day, you'd have an event, you'd have a performance, somebody would have a show at a gallery, and everybody would show up, and the importance of that coming together in a space.
Yeah, and that, I mean, because that's theater. If you go back to the origins of theater, it's somebody lights a campfire and everybody comes and sits around in a circle and somebody does an oral history, somebody narrates something. I mean, the next opera we're doing, Deidamia, is based on Greek myth, but, like, you know, not Homer, like pre-Homer, fragments from some poem that was handed down in an oral way. And so that's another reason when people are kind of, or I guess what I mean to say is that there's this thing in opera where sometimes people are like, oh, well, the story is about Achilles and Deidamia, and so they need to be wearing togas, and it needs to be on an island, and it blah, 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 blah. And I'm kind of like, no. It's about, what's interesting to me about the story is it's about, like, this young boy and this young girl who are falling in love and navigating all the powerful feelings that are coming out from adolescent first love. To me, that's what the story is about. So, and part of me is because I'm like, the story is poetry. The story is not, the story is something that's been handed down that's meant to be experienced by a group to encounter those feelings. So I guess that's like the thing that interests me about opera and about theater as an event.
Is there anything else that you feel needs to go on the record?
I don't know. I guess if people are listening to this decades from now, it would be cool for them to have a taste of just what an incredible... I would love them to be able to, like, walk around with me that first time, that first day that I visited, and just, like, the beauty of this town and these people who were, yeah, totally, like, pioneers. Pioneers isn't really the right word. My friend said it really well. It's just like, it was the most talented people you've ever met, and they were all just, like, in one, up and down one street, and it was just, it was so authentic. And I wonder what this town will be like in 20 years, in 30 years. Will it, like, is this a place that draws authenticity towards it and supports it. Like, will, is that the through line? Because I've also now only been here for 15 years, and I've seen that's changed, but it's still an incredible place. And so I'm like, what's going to happen in the next? What's the story of this place? Because obviously there's something bigger than us going on. But also, somebody, another colleague of mine has this phrase, everything has a life, talking about like a theater or a restaurant or things have a life. They have a kind of, if you stick around long enough, you can kind of watch the beginning and end of something. And so it's, if you find something that's really awesome, you should probably just like really grab a hold of it and enjoy it as much as you can, because it's probably not going to last forever. That's a bleak way to end this oral history. Anyway, I just feel very grateful to be in Hudson right now, and it's still the coolest place that I've ever been to. How's that for a closer?
That's great. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing the magic of this place, the freedom to create here.
Pleasure.